Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for being here. Appreciate you showing up. It is Sunday again, and I'm sitting here in my comfortably cramped closet considering what I want to speak with you about today and what we're going to think about. What are we going to rationalize or anti-rationalize? What are there to feel about? Is there an intelligible connection between some subject that we can make endearing? I like to perpetuate some idea of curiosity. I think my natural knack for the world is an unfillable thirst for knowledge. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the philosophical bins that I'm going down now are in inverse of gathering knowledge, and it doesn't always require having to have like an Easter egg hunt per se. But I think curiosity and having that it's a desire, of course, but it's a strange type of desire. There's a special thing that happens when a new piece of information helps make the picture clearer, and it fascinates me. And I used to call it the spark, and in a lot of ways it's like that light bulb moment in the cartoons where you see the kid or sitting at the table, and like all of a sudden the light bulb lights up above their head and there's that aha moment. You know, I call that curiosity, and I think it's infectious. I think that we all have our own bent. We all have our own section of the world, you know. One of the philosophers I would like to discuss today is the Western thinker Plato, part of the three pinnacle Greek thinkers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and chronological order. I have a whole episode towards the beginning of this whole shebang called Greek something. It's got a picture of like a Greek statue on it, where I very in-depth discuss these Greek philosophers. I'm going to be specializing on just one treatise by Plato today, and so I'm not going to go through all that. But one of Plato's thinkings, and it's not something I agree with fully, is that there is a different types of people. There's different acuities that people are born with. And in a lot of ways, I call that brightness. But it's not exactly intelligence, really, because there's no real way to measure it. And it's not calculable. There's not certain facts that you have to know in order to be bright. You know, like brightness is an edge. It's an approach to the world. It's a curiosity, really, you know? And Plato thought that the best type of society was a specialized society, which, yeah, again, I don't agree with fully, but he thought that there were certain tasks meant for certain people, and certain people were better at certain things, and that if you had a village, you know, you would want somebody to be able to make the clothing or to be the merchant. It would be really exhausting to have to be the farmer, the animal person, and the merchant. Like, if you had to do all the tasks in all of society, like if I had to go make my own food right now and gather my own gasoline, like, we live in a type of society where other people do that for you, and because of specialization you can focus on different interests. And Plato saw this as advantageous. And so within different acuities in people, in the best place or the best job for you in this type of society, you know, and arguably maybe there's a different society out there and a different way of being, which is where I sort of divorce. I don't think it's just one way to be, especially in government, you know, and I don't know, I'm losing myself. So I think that we can still be infectious with our own breed of curiosity to other people, even if their interests are not what our interests are. And I think that's one of the most important parts about being human, is just spreading that spark and getting people interested in life and wanting to go discover and explore, you know? All right, I'm gonna go grab a quote real quick because it'll perfectly segue into my next piece. I'll be right back. All right, this is from my Alan Watts book that I'm currently reading called Cloud Hidden, Whereabouts Unknown, A Mountain Journal. Very serious title, but I love him. He's one of my favorite thinkers, and his usage of words is just always exhilarating for me. So here goes. Let me illustrate why. Once there was a fish who lived in the great ocean, and because the water was transparent and always conveniently got out of the way of his nose when he moved along, he didn't know he was in the ocean. Well, one day, the fish did a very dangerous thing, and he began to think, "Surely, I am the most remarkable being, since I can move around like this in the middle of empty space." Then the fish became confused because of the thinking about moving and swimming, and he suddenly had an anxiety paroxysm and thought he had forgotten how. At that moment, he looked down and saw the yawning chasm of the ocean depths, and he was terrified that he would drop. Then he thought, "If I could catch hold of my tail and my mouth, I could hold myself up." And so he curled himself up and snapped at his tail. Unfortunately, his spine wasn't quite supple enough, so he missed. As he went on trying to catch hold of his tail, the yawning black abyss below became even more terrible, and he was brought to the edge of a total nervous breakdown. The fish was about to give up when the ocean, which had been watching with mixed feelings of pity and amusement, said, "What are you doing?" "Oh," said the fish, "I am terrified of falling into the deep dark abyss, and I'm trying to catch hold of my tail and my mouth to hold myself up." So the ocean said, "Well, you've been trying that for a long time now, and still you haven't fallen down. How come?" "Oh, of course, I haven't fallen down yet," said the fish. Because I am swimming." "Whoa," came the reply. "I am the great ocean, in which you live and move and are able to be a fish. And I haven't given all of myself to you in which to swim, but here you are, instead of exploring the length, breadth, depth, and height of my expanse, are wasting your time pursuing your own end." From then on, the fish put his own end behind him, where it belonged, and set out to explore the ocean. Yeah. I really like that. And it's this idea of seeing our functional holding ourselves up by our tail. A degree of trust and a degree of faith, perhaps. It's this idea of being able to listen to what's going on. And listening to the universe, or God, or nature, or the outside, the world, even if you want to limit it to just your society, your people, your family, whatever circle that you find yourself in, there's this interconnection of everything that holds it all up. And in this ocean metaphor, it would be the water. And the fish is swimming in the water and has become ambivalent and even ignorant of the existence of the water holding him. Now, we're not inside the ocean, and we don't have that same exact situation, but there is still this essence of, I guess a good word for it would be space, that holds everything up. Physically and temporally. You know, there's this movement towards something, some energy pattern that keeps fluctuating. You know, there's some aspect of this whole thing that is magnetic. You know, and I feel that whatever our purpose is part of that connectivity. And I say all this to help describe this idea of unconditional love. You know, and Plato had a wonderful idea of love, and it's an idea you hear about a lot because we call it Platonic love, and we use it without even, at least I didn't realize, the actual reference to Plato. And for this Platonic love, it's the formal love. Okay? So Plato had this distinction, this separate world, this other place, other space, where there was the real idea of anything. So let's break that down a little bit. So like, say, for instance, there are a trillion different types of flowers out on this planet. And a lot of flowers are beautiful. And some are ugly and stinky. But usually, universally, when we look at a flower, it's indistinguishably a flower. So there's this idea of flower that Plato would say is naturally and intrinsically in your brain. And whenever you see one, you relate it to that instinctive flower. That's the formal flower. So everything has a true form in this world of forms that we see through this illusionary basis of whatever. So I'm standing in my closet right now, and I got fucking 300 shirts on racks in front of me. And they're all different colors, but they're all shirts, right? So I have a categorical shirt here. And categories is going to be a Kantian term. You know, and I don't exactly agree that there's an actual world out there with formal ideas. And that's where Plato was convinced. He thought ideals and the ideas of things were true realities, and sense data empirically was not trustworthy. You know? So this formal idea of love is, for him, the Platonic love would be outside of necessity. You know, love is the good. And what is the good? Good is what the purpose of something is. When something is performing its purpose, it's acting in the good. And Plato, funny enough, through the mouth of Socrates, his puppet, uses the senses that he distrusts to find their purposes. So for an ear to be good, to perform well, an ear hears. So its purpose is the act of hearing. And so Plato would argue that every single thing and every single object and idea even has a formal purpose. And if it's performing its purpose, it's within the good. And of course, this starts to get very, very, very murky. It's hard to morally and ethically, like, nail down what the good is. And I think it evolves. I think goodness evolves over time, and it turns into different things, and there's different reasons to stand up in different situations. And so to be in the good, in my mind, requires vigilance and awareness in all these unique moments, this perpetually extended infinite moment of presentness that we find ourselves in, is constantly giving us new choices and new opportunities to make these choices on what we do. And stoically, within the Aurelian, Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher king, would say that the only thing we can control is our reactions to situations. You know, existentialists and other sort of philosophers would argue why we choose our reactions and what our volitions are, but that's just a murkier cave to go down. I would like to think, within a certain reasonable space of movement, of flexibility for myself, that I do have the free will to choose my actions and choose my reactions. I choose to believe that. And I know that there's probably background causation. There's probably a long list of cause and effect and things that made me feel the way I do, but I choose to live in the present moment. And when I analyze my situations that I'm approaching, I think, what's the best thing I could do right now? You know? What would be the right thing? And these are highly subjective terms, people. These are not things that you could find outside of who you are. You know, nobody can tell you what the right way to do. The law, the written constitution of whatever country you find yourself in, is not a book of the right way to do things. Our ethical codes are subjective and personal things. You know, and I think that's part of what all of our purposes, that's what makes us good on this planet, is an effort to be curious towards finding meaning. And I think part of finding meaning is finding our own ethical core. And I think the more we look at the world, the more we try to understand things, it's hard to not care. It's hard to be nihilistic. And maybe I'm just an optimist. I'll admit that. Maybe I'm just a sap and I look at the best in people. But I truly believe that with a little bit of curiosity and seeking and looking for meaning, no matter where that is, it makes people better, and it makes people want to build their own ethical core. My books of morals and ethics and the way I treat people was written by one person, me, you know? And I was discussing this with a friend last night, you know, and I was looking at my books, and I had a self-help book, and it was an easy one. And I was like, hey, if I gave you the self-help book, would you read it? And he was like, nah. Like, pretty quickly, too. He knew it immediately. And I was like, well, what do you do to look for foundations to build what you want to be and how you want to think about things? Like, all night long, he'd been discussing his chemical imbalances and these ideas on how, you know, to me, it felt like he was describing himself as inadequate, which was something I would disagree with, being the friend on the outside. And he says, I talked to my counselor. And I was like, confused, because those aren't my expectations for my therapist. Those aren't my expectations for any person. You know, even the dead people in the books that I'm reading. I don't expect to find answers in my books, in my process of seeking. And I'm not also encouraging everybody to follow my exact path. And I wasn't telling my friend to. My favorite thing is books, and so I'm always trying to give a book away. It's my favorite thing. But not a lot of people like it. That maybe not might be their method. Fortunately, there's physical things we can do, like meditation, being in nature, you know, finding groups of other like-minded individuals to have community, satsang. You know, like, there's a lot of other ways to go about it. But the process of wanting to seek it, quote unquote, and all of its vagary, you know, and maybe knowing when we're over seeking it. In my case, sometimes I burn myself out with over seeking. I have to chill the fuck out and sit down and breathe sometimes. But when I go see my therapist, I bring to it all the things I've thought about, all the work I've done in my life, right? It's the same way I think about psychedelics. Psychedelics as a whole do not give people the answer, just like the books don't, just like the church won't, just like your therapist won't, you know? The important part about psychedelic work is the next day when you're not on it, when you're not chemically assisted, it's noticing the patterns of being, you know, the patterns of thought. The Buddha said, you are your thoughts. The world is a product of thought. Everything is what you think. And all the complications and the compulsions of that. My point is there is a holistic perspective when looking at this shindig called life. And in a material society like mine that says that there's a pill that can fix you, there's a therapeutic method that's going to rewire your brain and is going to fix you, I think those are dangerous ideas to be perpetuating. Because that's the cart pulling the horse, really, metaphorically. And I would say there's certain life patterns, thought patterns, that if you struggle through them and you insist on changing patterns and seeking meaning, I think it naturally betters us. We find that platonic good. We find that essence of our purpose. And logotherapy, like Viktor Frankl, you know, when we find our purpose, when we find our meaning, we switch the cart and the horse. All of a sudden, we got our pull. We can start moving again and we feel better. But, oh, I don't feel good, so I can't do that. I can't make those choices. Okay? If we never make those choices, we lean on a chemical, even a psychedelic, even a method, then we don't learn how to walk on our own legs. It's difficult making meaning, making life, writing your own story. I'd like to read something I wrote towards the beginning of the week. This has to do with relating to our own effort and thinking about why we do things. Sometimes I become demoralized because I put a lot of effort out, and I try to remind myself that I do this as an act of life. Marcus Aurelius said, "Why wake up in the morning and resist your being as a human? You woke up as a human. Why would you not go do the work of a human?" Just like the bees wake up and they go do the work of the bees, right? So I think I was mad at somebody else's efforts or somebody not recognizing mine, and that's why I wrote this. How can I use this moment constructively? I can remind myself of service. I work on any plane, firstly and foremost, for something past myself. I devote my action to the world as a tool for the right and the good. Rightfulness, of course, being sketchy and impermanent ground, I still seek and strive for it. Maladaptively, I have based my value on the work, although always it should be the other way around, and the work should be good because of my value. It does not matter if anyone see or observe my purpose. I do not need validation or acceptance to love and accept them. It's just a simple reversal of the perception of the situation. And I want to be able to learn from that. Even though I wrote it, it's hard to live that way. But really, that's the biggest lesson I've been working on this week, is finding my way to comfortably do the right thing, to do what I need to do. So we had this major disaster in my city this week. Monday last week, almost a week ago now, I rolled up to my place of business, my job, and there was no lights. There was no lights on the entire walk up there. And I knew immediately something was wrong. So I called my boss and was like, "Hey, all the walk-ins are off, you know, the freezer's off. I think something big's going on." And I talked to a security guard outside of the building, and lo and behold, there was an electrical fire underground, and the sewers lit up. And apparently, there was a section of manhole covers that were projecting flames feet into the air, right? So they evacuated all the people who lived in like a 4-block radius, and because of carbon monoxide or some shit like that. And, you know, my place was shut down. And I was really burdened that morning trying to figure out what the right thing was to do. And that's what brought up this whole thought process, because I've been thinking about it all week. You know, and I felt so bad for leaving because I was offered to be able to stay and do some cleaning. But the place was pitch dark. And, you know, I had thought that maybe I could have hung out for a little bit. But I went home. Honestly, the best thing I could have done. And I'm happy I did. But that's about it for my yarn. Hope you guys have a great rest of your week. I'm forever grateful for this opportunity, as always. This show is meant to be a plea for help, a plea to help, not for help. I want to make something that's functionally usable by somebody out there in these form of these monologues. And future dialogues between me and my esteemed guests, which hopefully we'll have some soon. But either way, thank you for showing, and I'm gonna read you a couple quotes and we'll get out of here. So this first one is from Plato, the philosopher I've been talking about throughout the show, and this is from his Republic, where they're trying to make a city and make a constitution and have it be functional. And they were doing it 2,500 years ago, so a lot of it's dated. But I like a lot of it still, too. We might agree and disagree. When the sun has seen and known all this, he is a ruined man, and his fear has taught him to knock ambition and passion head foremost from his bosom's throne. Humbled by poverty, he takes to money making and by any means, and miserly savings and hard work gets a fortune together, is not such a one likely to seat the concupiscent and covetous element on the vacant throne, and to suffer it to play the great king with him, girt with tiara and chain and scimitar? And when he has made reason and spirit sit down on the ground obediently on either side of their sovereign and taught them to know their place, he compels the one to think only of how lesser sons may be turned into larger ones. And he will not allow the others to worship and admire anything but riches and rich men, or to be ambitious of anything so much as the acquisition of wealth and the means of acquiring it. Now, I think Plato's language here reeks of metaphor. Think of the sovereign king, passion and ambition, the contentious elements, reason and spirit, all are parts of the hypothetical sun being described to here. Plato's attempt is to show the progression of a man addicted to honor and power, and then to a man addicted to wealth, a further abstraction from what a good man, which is one who works for philosophical purposes. Now, next, I want to read another one from Allen. When we consider energy itself, the mutual interdependence of positive and negative, of white ones and black offs is still more obvious, because all energy is a vibration or pulsation, or a propagation of waves. Unless plus and minus, on and off, wave crest and wave trough alternate, there simply is no energy. It is therefore tempting to assume that all negative aspects of the universe imply and involve the positive, and vice versa, in such a way that the notion of final and absolute blackness is as absurd as its opposite. But when the white positive is seen as the real thing, there's always the fear that light and life may be overcome by darkness and death. However, the notion of plus and minus as generating one another in an eternal rhythm is far less a strain on my credulity and imagination than the idea of a brief and mysterious firing of energy occurring once and once only in the black waste of the void. Yeah. I like that one. I still got to think on that one more to understand it for me. But, yeah. Thank you for being here. I'm going to go ghetto and we'll sign out.
Hello! It's Asko again. How are you guys doing? Are you doing good?
Mm-hmm. How are you?
How are you?
I don't know. How are you?
Pretty good.
Okay.
Yep.
You got anything cool to say?
No, not today.
Okay. Is that all you wanted to talk about?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll see you next week.
Okay.
Bye.